What does Yamaha do? That question probably divides the room into two camps. Some of you are thinking, well, Yamaha makes motorbikes. Others of you are thinking, well, Yamaha makes pianos. And oddly enough, then, both camps, of course, are right. It seems strange, doesn't it, that one company should specialize in both of those things. I mean, a motorbike, it makes such an unpleasant and raucous noise. A piano, on the other hand, makes a delightful melodic sound. Then again, a piano remains always rooted to the same spot, except where moved with great difficulty so that you can paint the wall behind it. A motorbike, on the other hand, whizzes about all the time at lightning speeds. But nonetheless, Yamaha does motorbikes and it does pianos. And in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 15, it emerges that the church is a bit like Yamaha. There are two different things that it specializes in. So on the one hand, it specializes in behavior. If I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God. But then on the other hand, it specializes in truth, because Paul continues, a pillar and buttress of the truth. That is to say, it has a message that it holds aloft for all to see. That's the pillar bit, and that it protects and maintains and keeps intact. That's the buttress bit. So behavior and truth, Yamaha-like, the church has two arms, two areas of interest. However, in a way that doesn't seem to apply to motorbikes and pianos, the church's two areas of interest are intimately connected. Because in one phrase in verse 16, Paul brings them together, and that phrase is the mystery of godliness. So the mystery, that's another word for the truth, the message which the church parades and defends. When calling it a mystery, Paul isn't saying that it's somehow confusing and unintelligible. It's a very specific term for Paul, this term, mystery. It means that for a long time, this message was unknown, but now it has been revealed. He goes on to sum up the mystery, the truth, the message, in the remainder of verse 16, and in a word, it's all about Christ. So the mystery, that's one half of this phrase, but then the mystery of godliness. In other words, the church's mystery, its truth, its message about Christ, it produces, it leads to, it's the basis of the church's godly behavior. And so, as I say, the church isn't randomly and oddly into both behavior and truth, rather the former flows very much out of the latter. And it's important that we're all clear on that. There'll be no distinctive behavior in the church without a fierce commitment to the message, the truth, the mystery of Jesus Christ. In the early part of the 20th century, many churches up and down the land abandoned the message of Jesus Christ. It dispensed with his virgin birth and his sin-atoning work and his bodily resurrection, and it simply emphasized being neighborly and being charitable and being hard-working. And it was a disaster. And those churches died a slow death, and today their buildings are nightclubs and warehouses. There will be no distinctive behavior in the church without a fierce commitment to the message of Jesus Christ. But equally, there should be no prioritizing of the message of Jesus Christ that is not accompanied by behavioral transformation. Sadly, however, churches known for their zealous adherence to the truth have sometimes actually been the worst for infighting and divisions and various forms of ugly behavior. I'm saying neither of the church's two specialities must be allowed to eclipse the other. They belong together. The church is to be big on its mystery, its supernaturally revealed body of truth, but that mystery is always the mystery of godliness. Practical godliness must ride on the coattails of the mystery that we proclaim and defend. Now, remember I said a moment ago that the remainder of verse 16 sums up then the mystery. That is to say, it focuses on the truth side of the church's two specialities, the message of Jesus Christ, which the church so prizes and treasures. And over three Sunday mornings then, we're going to consider this verse. I try in my preaching to give you a balanced biblical diet. And I'm very conscious then that being in a letter of Paul's in the morning and another letter of Paul's in the evening doesn't really meet that standard. But I guess my one mitigation, and it is scraping the barrel a bit, I admit, my one mitigation is that in the mornings we're going to be camped in a single verse, whereas in the evenings we're moving through a much larger block of material. So in that sense, at least, there is a degree of variation and balance. Now, when it comes to 1 Timothy 3:16, I suspect that it's a verse which tantalizes many of you. You're drawn to it, as I've said already. It's all about Christ, and that automatically endears it to us. Then again, it's made up of such pithy, memorable little phrases, isn't it? Then again, it has such an upbeat, triumphant kind of tone to it. So as I say, as a Christian, you're definitely drawn to 1 Timothy 3:16, but at the same time, you can't quite pin it down, can you perhaps? You're not sure what exactly some of the phrases mean, and you're not sure about the arrangement of the material either, whether it's logical and orderly or in fact all over the place. That's the tension I suspect many of you will have experienced over the years with this verse. The potential seems to be there to enjoy some inspiring views of our Lord Jesus Christ here, but various awkwardnesses in the text just seem to present that potential from being realized. Well, let's try just now to ease ourselves into the verse. So the first thing to say about it is that it is all about Christ. He's not mentioned by name, of course, but only a very contrary person indeed would attempt to argue that someone else is in view here. Christ is immediately recognizable, is he not, from what is said in these lines. The verse is a list of things that happened to him. I'm putting it like that because all the verbs here are, of course, passive verbs. It's a list of experiences which Christ undergoes. So you're all with me so far. Here's another nice straightforward point. There are six lines. There are six lines here. It doesn't matter which Bible version you're using, I think at least. There are six lines. And those six lines are in proper chronological order. So reading these six lines, we don't kind of take one step forwards chronologically and then two steps back or anything like that. We're constantly moving forwards. Now, that I know is a statement that many of you will feel I need to justify. I'm not going to do so at this point. For now, you'll just have to take my word for it. The next thing to talk about is how these six lines are set out. And in that respect, the ESV, it seems to me, does a fantastic job. The way that it indents the lines is exactly right. So the New King James Version, it doesn't indent any of the lines here, suggesting that you can't identify any patterns, any distinct units among them. The NIV, on the other hand, it indents the second, fourth, and sixth lines, suggesting that the whole thing is divided into three couplets. The ESV, however, as you can see, it indents the lines in such a way as to suggest two verses with three lines each. So, he was manifested in the flesh, vindicated by the Spirit, seen by angels. That's verse 1. And then, proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, taken up in glory. That's verse 2. And that, I think, makes by far the best sense of the material. So, thinking in terms of those two verses then, verse 1, he was manifested in the flesh, vindicated by the Spirit, seen by angels. It covers the chronological period from the Nativity to the Ascension. And then verse 2, proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, taken up in glory, it covers the chronological period from the day of Pentecost to the day of the Lord. So still, I hope you're finding all this fairly easy to follow. Now, however, I want to stretch you a little bit more. Because in this dividing of the lines into two verses, something else is going on as well. And it's this. The events of verse 2 kind of replay, or at least correspond to, the events of verse 1. That is to say, what happens to Christ from the day of Pentecost to the day of the Lord follows the same pattern as what happens to Christ from the Nativity to the Ascension. In both those two phases, you can trace the same basic contours. And I'm going to spend about 30 seconds now mapping that out for you, but please don't worry if you don't really get it, because what I'm going to say in the next 30 seconds, we're going to unpack in the rest of the series. So here's the very quick mapping out of the whole thing. Basically, both phases, so from the Nativity to the Ascension and from the day of Pentecost to the day of the Lord, in both phases, these three things happen. In both phases, Christ is strangely displayed. Line 1, manifested in the flesh. Line 4, proclaimed among the nations. Secondly, in both phases, Christ is powerfully confirmed. Line 2, vindicated by the Spirit. Line 5, believed on in the world. And then thirdly, in both phases, Christ is magnificently honored. Line 3, seen by angels. Line 6, taken up in glory. So that's what is going on as a whole. And just in the remainder of our time this morning, let's think then about how in both phases, Christ is strangely displayed. Christ is strangely displayed. There's a funny clip that you can watch online from the Australian TV coverage of the Queen's funeral last year. And it's the moment when the British Prime Minister at the time, Liz Truss, arrives with her husband at Westminster Abbey, and they walk up the steps into the building. And the two commentators on this Australian TV channel are flummoxed at this point. With each new arrival outside Westminster Abbey, they've been telling their viewers exactly who it is that's getting out of the car. But when it comes to Liz Truss and her husband, they don't have a clue. And so you hear them discussing whether these might be some minor royals that are getting out of the car now. Well, it looks like they could be local dignitaries, one of the commentators says. At which point, one of them clearly receives a message in the earpiece, and he says, "Oh, I've just been told it's the British Prime Minister." And I suppose then their struggle to recognise her is partly due to the fact that she has only just at that point become Prime Minister. She wouldn't last very long either, but that's another matter. But it also reflects, I guess, our British system, in which the role of the Prime Minister is not meant to be a flashy role. Other countries, and some of you here this morning are from them, other countries have presidents whom you could never possibly fail to recognize because they travel the world in a special presidential aeroplane and they get escorted through cities in motorcades, and when they turn up at events, people stand up and the national anthem is played and all that kind of stuff. Presidents display themselves in a grand and impressive way. Now, the person here in 1 Timothy 3:16 isn't a president. He's infinitely more important. He's the eternal Son of God. And line one begins then, he was manifested in what? He was manifested in a much publicized visit to this world, accompanied by an angelic entourage and complete with a personalized jet and motorcade. Is that what it says? Because he's the Son of God, remember? He utterly dwarfs the most eminent figures to be found anywhere on this planet. How grandly and impressively is he going to display himself? But look at how Paul finishes the line. He was manifested in the flesh. the flesh. Now, I've mentioned that word a few times recently, and that common way then in which it's used in the New Testament to denote sin. That's what the flesh often means. It's the impulse to sin and to rebel. That's not what the flesh means here. Here, it means that creaturely form, that creaturely constitution in which all of us exist. The best summary of the flesh in this sense is in those well-known words of Matthew 26, verse 41. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. The flesh is weak. And that doesn't just apply to that sleepy trio in the Garden of Gethsemane in Matthew 26. It applies to all human beings since the fall. We are jars of clay, as Paul puts it elsewhere. Physically limited and fragile. Mentally limited and fragile. That's what this term, the flesh, has in view. It refers to the human constitution, I'm saying, in all its breakableness. And Christ then was manifested in that. In that. Presidents are displayed through the media of blacked out limos and noisy stadium rallies. The eternal Son of God was displayed through the medium of the flesh. A finite mind that got overwhelmed and agitated and could only process so much. A finite body that got hungry and tired and ultimately tortured and killed. Nothing grand, nothing impressive. Truly, in the incarnation, Christ is strangely displayed. But that was back then. What about now? What about in this post-Pentecost period? How is he displayed? Some of you, 3 weeks tomorrow, will at a certain point in the afternoon switch on the TV and watch King Charles sitting in a stately room in Buckingham Palace or Windsor Castle or wherever it is as he addresses you in his annual Christmas speech. When you first saw the Lord Jesus, there was a line about that, wasn't there, in one of our hymns this morning. Where is the blessedness I knew when first I saw the Lord? When you first saw the Lord and were captivated by his beauty and his all-sufficiency, was it through something like that? Did you switch on a screen and watch him sitting there on his throne in the courts of heaven as he addressed you? And were you just wowed by the augustness of the whole scene that was playing out before your eyes? No, it wasn't like that at all, was it? You were at a meeting, perhaps, in a stuffy church building, at which some guy with few gifts and little eloquence and no great charisma stood at a lectern and tried to explain some words in a book. Or perhaps you were having coffee with a Christian friend who was trying to convert you, and who kept overcomplicating things and answering your questions really, really poorly. It was in circumstances such as those that you first saw the Lord. That's how he was displayed. He was proclaimed to you. That's what line 4 says. That's how Christ is displayed in this post-Pentecost period. He's not beamed onto screens in live broadcasts from heaven. He's proclaimed in the feeble words of feeble human beings. And so you see then how in both phases Christ is strangely displayed. Back in phase 1, he was manifested in the flesh of all things. Now in phase 2, he's proclaimed just ploddingly, unspectacularly proclaimed among the nations. It's also counterintuitive, isn't it? This person of matchless, unrivaled greatness displayed in these ways. It's so contrary to what you'd expect. What should we make of it? Well, 3 thoughts as we close. 3 words. And first of all then, security. Security, that's my first word, by which I mean this. Because Christ, being the eternal Son of God, is truly and objectively and incontestably great, he's secure in that greatness, and thus not averse to being displayed in these strange ways. Listen to Charles Spurgeon. This is what he says. He says, it is most possible that the very reason of his meekness and lowliness, he's talking about Christ, it's most possible that the very reason of his meekness and lowliness may lie somewhere in his glorious greatness, though it may seem a paradox. For who are the meekest in the world but those who are truly strong? You shall pass down the street and a yelping dog will bark at you, but yonder powerful mastiff takes no note of you. A cackling goose will follow you upon the village green, while the powerful ox feeds on in peace. Real strength is the backbone of meekness. When a man is fond of dignity, pomp, and show, he's a second-rate man, and an essentially little man. Those who stick out for minute points of honour and respect are the very small men. The man who must have all his titles written after his name shows that he feels he needs them. Look into the army, Spurgeon says. Every petty officer is bedizened to the full, but the commander-in-chief is plainly dressed and scarcely wears an ornament at all, simply because he is great. It's true, isn't it? I've mentioned before that when walking to here on a morning, I often see the Newcastle footballers driving down the main road there to the training ground. And as far as I'm aware from my very unscientific survey of the matter, there are two of them that drive cars with private personalised number plates. One has his initials on it, the other has his full surname on it. And do you know what? Those are two of the most fringe players in the entire Newcastle United squad. They aren't great footballers who you're ever going to see playing in the Champions League final or lifting the World Cup trophy. And there's clearly then an insecurity about them. They need people to recognise them. They need fancy number plates so that people will go, oh wow, that's so-and-so who plays for Newcastle every now and again at least. The Son of God isn't like that. Instead, we see in him this contentment for 30-odd years to exist in the flesh, turning no heads, attracting no second glances. This contentment, moreover, for 2,000 years now and counting, to be ineptly proclaimed by numpties like me. I'm saying none of that questions how great Christ really is. On the contrary, it shows how great Christ really is. And so please don't dismiss Christ this morning on the basis that if he were really a great being, he wouldn't display himself so unspectacularly. Remember Spurgeon's commander-in-chief. Remember the top Newcastle United players who drive around with very ordinary number plates. Turn your logic on its head, I'm saying, and realise that someone secure enough to display himself so unspectacularly must be a really great being. That's my first word, security. Second word, relationship. Relationship. Christ wants a genuine heart-to-heart relationship with you. He doesn't want to dazzle you with a super-duper display of himself and sweep you into a superficial relationship in which you actually love the super-duper display more than you love Christ himself. I mean, suppose the President of the United States were to make a grand visit to Benton. Unlikely, but suppose it were to happen. And the motorcade was passing through, and you might go out then onto the street and take tons of pictures and get very excited and thoroughly enjoy the whole experience. And in years to come, tell your grandchildren about the day the president came to Benton. And you might do all that irrespective of what you think of Joe Biden as a person and as a president. It's the super-duper display that has captivated you rather than the person himself. Now think of Simeon. And he's holding that little child in his arms. He's looking at that little child in his arms, that child who probably, like most children, has a runny nose. That child who is probably acting quite shyly and uncomfortably because he's been thrust into the arms of a strange man. There's nothing awe-inspiring about that sight that Simeon is looking at in his arms. And Simeon sees through the manifestation in the flesh. And he says, "My eyes have seen your salvation." Or think of that criminal hanging on a cross outside Jerusalem one Friday afternoon. And he's looking at a man on an adjacent cross who is stark naked and covered in blood and fighting just to take his next breath. And he's the butt of everyone's jokes. An abject sight, if ever there was one. And that criminal sees through the manifestation in the flesh and says, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." Or think of the centurion at the same scene. And he's looking at a man on that middle cross who has now gone beyond the point of fighting for each breath he's taking. He's not breathing anymore. He's just a motionless corpse with his head hanging limp. A sight that screams out defeat and futility and hopelessness. And that centurion sees through the manifestation in the flesh and says, "Truly this man was the Son of God." Christ, I'm saying, wants men and women and boys and girls like that. Like Simeon. Like that criminal. Like that centurion. Men and women and boys and girls who see through the strange display to the glory and the beauty of this person. Men and women and boys and girls who can come to a service at NREC which has no flashing lights, and no smoke machines, and no dance team, and no slot for people to come to the front and be healed. And they can just listen to a Yorkshireman standing at the front droning on and on inelegantly, and they can leave smiling and moved in their hearts, singing, "If ever I love thee, my Jesus, 'tis now." Are you that kind of person? Do you need razzmatazz and pyrotechnics and aesthetic stimulation when you go to church in order to smother and sugarcoat a Christ whom you don't actually find all that attractive in himself? Or are you so enamored with Christ himself that you're uninterested in gimmicks? Plain old proclamation will do. Christ wants a heart-to-heart relationship with people who love him himself. Him himself. Security, relationship, and then one more word. Brilliance. Brilliance. Imagine that one day, long before the nativity in Bethlehem, the Son of God in heaven there, imagine he confided in an angel. And he said to this angel, "I am going to display myself to the world." And the angel replied, "Wow, that sounds like a wonderful idea, my Lord. How are you going to do it? What medium are you going to use?" "Flesh," comes back the reply. "I'm going to display myself in a frail human constitution. I'm going to display myself through being initially a little baby. Then an ordinary Jewish man, and then at the end, a disgraced outcast subjected to brutal crucifixion. That's how I'm going to display myself." At this point then, the angel is tottering a bit and looking a bit faint. But then the Son of God continues, "And that's not all. That's not all. After I've manifested myself in that way for 30 odd years, others will then take over the work of displaying me." "Oh," the angel says, perking up a bit at this, "so that's where I and my colleagues come in." Oh no," the Son of God replies. "The others I'm talking about aren't you angels. They are human beings, There'll be 12 of them initially. A few of them fishermen, one of them a tax collector, one of them a nationalist freedom fighter called a zealot. They will proclaim me. And over time, others will take up the same work. Slaves will proclaim me whenever their limited opportunities allow them to do so. Tradesmen will proclaim me as they travel from place to place, selling their wares. Women will proclaim me as they buy their food in the marketplace each day. That's how I'm going to display myself. And there's an awkward pause before the angel clears his throat and says, "My Lord, it goes without saying that all your ways are wise and perfect, but in this case, I just can't see how your displaying yourself that way can possibly work. The display is destined to go utterly unnoticed. Having manifested yourself in the obscurity and hiddenness of the flesh for 30-odd years, you'll be lucky if there are even 12 men sufficiently captivated by what they've seen to take up the work of displaying you. And if there are, well, fishermen and tax collectors and nationalist freedom fighters, not to mention slaves, tradesmen and women, all with no mechanisms at their disposal beyond mere word proclamation, well, they're not going to get very far, Lord. Displaying yourself in such a strange manner, Lord, that is bound to fail." That's what the angel would inevitably have said, and that's what anyone else would also have said. Which is why then the last three words there in line 4 are so breathtaking. Among the nations. Among the nations. And that isn't hyperbole on Paul's part. Even in his day, it wasn't hyperbole. And certainly now we can say that's not hyperbole. I mean, where in the world has Christ been displayed? It's actually easier to answer the question, isn't it, where in the world has Christ not been displayed? He's been displayed almost everywhere. I mean, you get a little flavour of that even in our own church. He's been displayed in Hong Kong. He's been displayed in Nepal. He's been displayed in Uganda. He's been displayed in India. He's been displayed in South Africa. He's been displayed in England, in Wales, in Scotland, in Northern Ireland. He's been displayed in Malawi, where Andrew is. He's been displayed in Japan, where Alan and Shona have just been. How on earth has that happened when he has displayed himself so strangely? How on earth have we gotten from that night in Bethlehem, when the display of Christ was confined to a tiny feeding trough in a tiny Judean town? The display there was so underwhelming, so ignored by the entire world that night. Nobody really knew it was going on. How on earth have we gotten from that, via just a whole load of motley human beings proclaiming and proclaiming and proclaiming, one generation after another, how on earth have we gotten in just 2 millennia to this point where Christ has been displayed all over the world? It's staggering, isn't it? It's staggering. Any strategist would say, look, if Christ wants to be seen on a global scale, he's got to display himself spectacularly and arrestingly and unmistakably. But instead, Christ displays himself in the weak fleshliness of Bethlehem's birth and Gethsemane's breakdown and Calvary's butchery. And then in the pathetic proclamation of incompetent human beings. And there's barely a corner of the planet where the display hasn't reached. Because God is the most brilliant strategist of all, you see. Worship him this morning for his brilliance, his unique, uninventable, unguessable way of doing things, displaying his son to the world from the craziest starting point. How silently the wondrous gift is given. And then through the craziest chain of flimsy verbal proclamation, and yet displaying his son to the world so effectively, so rampantly, so successfully, that there's barely a part of our globe where the display has not penetrated. What a God we have. What a God who so tears up our scripts, tears up our marketing strategies, tears up our policies and approaches and procedures, and does things in his own way and does them better than anybody else could do them. Worship this God who in the strangest way has displayed Christ to millions and millions and millions of human beings. Amen.